anti-war protests around the world as the CIA calls for lifting a ban on assassination and working with human rights abusers. We'll talk to Jennifer Harbury. And as Bush prepares for war, religious activists mobilize for peace. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush has asked Congress for authority to waive all existing restrictions on U.S. military assistance and weapons exports for the next 5 years to any country if he determines the aid will fight against international terrorism. The waiver would cover those nations currently ineligible for U.S. military aid because of their sponsorship of terrorism, such as Syria and Iran, or because of their nuclear and offensive weapons programs or lack of commitment to democracy, which he says would include Pakistan and China. Separately, on Saturday, Bush lifted all military and economic restrictions on India, and he also removed restrictions that barred Pakistan from economic assistance and that prevented it from making commercial military purchases from U.S. companies. The new proposal would also allow the president to lift restrictions based on human rights concerns that have been imposed by Congress on U.S. military cooperation with other countries, such as Turkey, Colombia, Indonesia, and others involved in massive human rights abuses. The blanket approach has raised outrage on Capitol Hill and among human rights groups that it risks undermining the hard-fought legal architecture that ensures that human rights concerns can be considered in U.S. military sales and training. As State Department legal spokesperson said, the blanket waiver would apply to all current prohibitions, including those related to human rights, terrorism, and non-payment of debt. The most sweeping human rights provision currently in effect is the so-called Leahy Law, which since 1997 has imposed limits on U.S. military assistance to all countries where rights abuses have been found within military and security forces. Taliban Defense Minister Mullah Obaidullah said today, Afghanistan is mobilizing an additional 300,000 men to help fight off any U.S. attack to punish Kabul for sheltering Osama bin Laden. Hundreds of thousands more were signing up to help fight a jihad or holy war against any U.S. invasion, Obaidullah said in a statement sent to Reuters in Kabul. He did not reveal the current size of the army, but Afghan analysts in Pakistan say it cannot be more than about 45,000 and may be depleted by defections as concern over threatened U.S. military action mounts. The leader of Taliban militia said today the United States must withdraw forces from the Gulf and support the Palestinians in their conflict with Israel if it wants to remove the threat of terrorism. In a statement faxed to news agencies, Mullah Mohammed Omar said the death of Osama bin Laden would do little to remove the threat against the United States. The brief statement appeared aimed not only at warning the United States against military action, but also at encouraging other Muslim nations to distance themselves from Washington's efforts to build an international coalition to combat terrorism. Meanwhile, the Taliban say they are trying to find Osama bin Laden. Signs were that the reclusive Mullah Omar was engaged in delicate political maneuvering to try to stave off attack by the world's mightiest army without being seen by his followers and the Muslim world to be abandoning bin Laden. The most wanted man in much of the world, with the United States raising the price on his head, is venerated by many Sunni Muslims who see him as striking back against U.S. imperialism. But the Mullah, Abdul Hai Mutmain, Taliban chief spokesperson, said the Taliban would not hand over the man named as the prime suspect in the September 11th devastating attacks in the United States that killed nearly 7,000 without proof of his involvement. He said by telephone from Kandahar, we rule out the possibility of his handover to America without substantial evidence. This news from Washington. Congressman Gary Condit, whose career was crumbling under scandal just 2 weeks ago, has been named to a new House subcommittee on Homeland Security. in late August, House leaders signaled they wanted to remove the California Democrat from the House Intelligence Committee after he gave evasive answers to police and reporters about his relationship with missing intern Chandra Levy. But the tragedy September 11th has wiped Condit from the headlines and enabled him to take a prominent place on the front lines of national defense. The task force was turned into a formal subcommittee late last week to work with and oversee President Bush's new anti-terror czar, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge. President Bush named Ridge to direct the Office of Homeland Security, a new cabinet-level position. Ridge will resign as governor October 5th. As Pennsylvania governor, his social agenda included dismantling welfare and a special legislative session on crime that gave birth to a three-strikes law and a faster death penalty process. Ridge has signed more than 200 execution warrants since becoming governor in 1995, including two death warrants for Mumia Abu-Jamal.
I had a perfect view, and the plane was coming in. I noticed it a second before it hit the building.
Train, entering the city. I lost myself and never came back. Took a trip around the world and never came back. Black silhouettes, crisscross tracks. Came back. Thought ever changed.
When they come by and they say, what happened?
A moment that will change everyone's life in this country, certainly here in New York City.
And you just gotta say, something hit the building, and then something hit both buildings.
Like a commercial plane, not a small plane. And I kept thinking, this is too low, it's too low, it's too low. And then it went right in.
Me and my coworkers were sitting at our desks. All of a sudden, the building just swayed.
I know there are 50,000 people who work in the World Trade Center. I know that every ambulance and every fire company in the city and has been called in and dispatched there.
We carried a bunch of people that we found laying in the debris. It was complete darkness. We stumbled over some people. We picked them up and carried them across the street.
My name is Joe Macaluso. I just want my mother and my family to know I'm alive. I was on the 34th floor when the planes hit. We didn't know what happened.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved.
"911 Emergency," produced by Peter Boshen, here on Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report, as we break the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands of people marched across New York on Friday night to call for peace and demand an end to attacks on Muslim and Arab communities, chanting, "War is not the answer, and Islam is not the enemy." The marchers work their way uptown from Union Square, where mourners have been holding nightly vigils for the missing and the dead since the Twin Towers were attacked on September 11th. The march was called on short notice by New York Direct Action Network and a loose anti-war coalition. It grew to be much larger than organizers expected. As the numbers swelled, hecklers called out to them in Midtown's busy streets, and many bystanders cheered the marchers or even joined in. As the march approached Times Square, where the Army recruiting station is, police began sectioning off groups of demonstrators from each other to break up the march, letting demonstrators out of barricaded areas only three or four at a time. Four marchers were arrested, three charged with disorderly conduct, and one with criminal impersonation. Before the march began, activists from the religious Arab and South Asian communities held a Muslim peace rally in a nearby park. Because police had revoked their rally permit and the organizers didn't feel safe without police protection, speakers addressed a small audience. Among them were Karen Robinson of the Human Rights Education Project at Amnesty International, followed by New York City Councilwoman Christine Quinn.
Salam, shalom, shanti, peace. We are here today to express our shock and grief at the tragic loss of lives due to the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Our thoughts and prayers are with those who have lost family members or loved ones and those who are missing. As Muslims, we condemn the heinous crime, grieve and mourn with our fellow Americans, and stand in solidarity with them.
Yes, on behalf of Amnesty International, our heartfelt sympathy goes out to the family and friends of the thousands of missing, dead, and injured people of last week's horrendous actions. And we condemn those actions as the ultimate violation of one's human rights. But as in the United States and our allies start to seek justice and hold the perpetrators accountable for those actions, we demand that they uphold human rights and that our actions do not violate the human rights of the thousands of citizens around the world that we potentially may violate.
That's right.
To that same end, Eleanor Roosevelt, at the 10-year anniversary of the UDHR, said, "Where, after all, do human rights start? They start in small places." And Amnesty International is appalled that in this country, Arab Americans and Muslims and people who have a certain look are being targeted and attacked and killed in their community for nothing more than what they look like. And we deplore this as an organization, again, as a violation of people's human rights. And as we move forward, healing from this tragedy, seeking justice, we ask that all of us remember the principles of human rights and what that means in your community and the actions that you can take, and voice your opinions to the U.S. government that we must live up to human rights law and humanitarian law in any of the actions we take, and that people who violate the rights of citizens of this country for nothing more than what they look like should also be held accountable.
My name is Christine Quinn, and I'm a member of the New York City Council. I actually represent the area where you are now standing. I'm sad that people in New York and Americans have responded to the tragedy at the World Trade Center by attacking other Americans and attacking New Yorkers. You know, we've all expressed our condolences to the families and the victims of the World Trade Center tragedy. And in fact, the officers from the 13th Precinct who are here with us today, two of their fellow officers are missing, you know, because they rushed down to help save people. I fail to understand how harassing or beating or hurting another human being will help any of the victims or their families. Attacking someone because you think they're South Asian, you think they're Muslim, you think they're Arab, will not bring one person back, it will not raise the World Trade Center back up, and it will never take us to where we were in our own minds and souls on September 10th. The only thing that perpetrating bias against another person because of their perceived race, ethnicity, or religion, the only thing that does is bring us all further apart, commit more crimes, and separate and divide us. So I'm here today to say that my office is fully supportive of this effort to stop this violence in New York City and across the country, and everything we can do, we will do as we move forward, and to make sure that the healing in this city includes creating unity between the Muslim, Arab, South Asian community and those who are not Muslim, South Asian, or Arab, and that what we foster is peace and unity, not horrible, tragic bias and violence. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
They want to go to war, and especially against the people of the Middle East. And we feel that this government is using this horrific tragedy that happened on September 11th as an excuse to widen a war against the peoples of the Middle East. Why are they bombing a poor country like Afghanistan? You know, a country whose government the U.S. has been supporting since the late 1970s. And we just feel that this is not the best way to honor the memory of the 6,000 plus people who lost their lives in the World Trade Center. What's going to happen to the families of these victims? War is not going to help them. They're going to need compensation. They're going to need a moratorium on foreclosures and layoffs. And, you know, so we just feel that there's a growing opposition to war. We're here to, in terms of being in the streets, to show the people of New York that the majority of people, we represent the majority of people in this city, in this country, who do not want a war.
Simply being somebody who doesn't believe in what's going on now and not being able to verbalize that in my work at work and like not being able, feeling afraid to say that to ordinary people I might want to talk to on the street because they'll say it because I'm not American, oh, go back home. I don't even want to have to deal with that. So that kind of thing, I'm feeling pressure. But I just feel like a lot of people don't know another way and there hasn't been enough energy spent on what other ways, you know, can be used to whatever, quote unquote, to like end terrorism. That word is even kind of shady for me. And so, yeah, like that's what I'm against, or that's what I have problems with. Cause you'd have to like sit and educate like whoever you're talking to about all the stuff that's been done to other countries and why possibly somebody might feel that it was necessary to attack the US like that. And that takes so much time that you don't really have when somebody's reacting on pure emotion because they're afraid and they've never been in this situation before.
I do feel that racist climate in this city. Like I'm South Asian, I'm not an Arab, which for me doesn't really make a difference because it's an arbitrary line. But that, yeah, that in a way that I never have before in New York, and I've lived here for 5 years, been stared at, and I've been in very, very negative ways. I've been like followed. So
recently?
Yeah, as recently as a couple hours ago.
They killed innocent people down there, and we don't, and we shouldn't defend ourselves. You guys are a disgrace. A goddamn disgrace you guys are.
Guys, just calm down.
People spilled their blood for this country. You guys are a disgrace. You're a goddamn disgrace. I'm a disgrace. You put it, you shouldn't even turn your head. You don't even have the right to look at me. I'm a disgrace. You don't even have the right to look at me.
After thinking about it, you have to want peace. I don't want World War III. World War III would be awesome. Devastating. It'd rip at the heart of America.
Peace, not war, the message of the large anti-war protest in New York this weekend. Thousands of people marched to Times Square, where the Army recruiting station stands. And as an island of a couple hundred people made it to the middle of Times Square, riot police moved in and pushed them out. Meanwhile, in Denver this weekend, in Denver, Colorado, five activists unfurled a banner that read, "Wage Peace Now," from a crane under images of Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., the Dalai Lama, and Jesus Christ. The activists were arrested and charged with a Class 3 felony, which is criminal mischief, and what they're calling the first high-profile direct action of the budding pro-peace movement in the United States and against the military activity in Afghanistan. The activists arrested were Jaime Bachnight, Yuri Koslin, Harrison Fox, Ginger Cassidy, and Amy Johnson. We are joined on the telephone now by Amy Johnson, who also works at Pacifica affiliate KGNU in Boulder. Welcome to Democracy Now! in Exile.
Thank you.
Well, can you tell us a little more about this banner and who organized it?
Well, it's a collective group called La Mitzvah, and it's a collective that is based on nonviolence and direct action, and we use a lot of humor and public displays of art to kind of get our message out. And there was five of us, and we climbed a crane right in downtown Denver, close to one of the main boulevards and the interstate that passes right through the city, and and unfolded the banner early in the morning and left it up there for a couple of hours. And it was just a pretty powerful experience, to say the least.
So how did you climb the crane?
We're all climbers, and we used our climbing gear. So we were really, really, really cautious and very protective of all of our gear and went to pretty extreme lengths to make sure that everything was secure and that we were safe.
And how did the police get you?
Well, after a couple of hours of hanging the banner, we climbed up and pulled the banner back up and put it in our backpack and climbed down and gave ourselves over to the police.
And again, describe the banner for us.
It was a 70 by 40 foot banner that said Wage Peace Now, and it had the Dalai Lama, Martin Luther King Jr., Jesus Christ, and Gandhi on it, all with images of just their faces.
And what was the response? What kind of coverage did you get?
We got a couple pieces of good coverage from some local stations. Overall, not as much coverage as we think it should have gotten. We're still kind of waiting. The newspapers really didn't give us much coverage. I mean, I heard that there was one little excerpt in the Denver newspaper that was, you know, maybe an inch long at the most, you know, followed by pages and pages of the pro-war propaganda.
And finally, the feeling in your community in the Boulder, Denver area around what's happening right now outside of your group?
Yeah, well, I think everybody's feeling a deep sorrow and sympathy for the victims of last week's attack, as well as the families, you know. It's just horrific. But I think that people are just, they're really hurt, and they're wanting justice. And, you know, what's in the media is basically the whole drumbeat for war. And I think that people are reacting a lot on just that one message and not knowing that there's so many other messages and other paths to peace and justice than just this one. And, you know, and people are definitely very emotional, and they have a right to be very emotional. But our concern is that there needs to be more dialogue around this issue in the airwaves and the media. Just need to open it up to more voices so that people can really make educated decisions on what we should do.
Amy Johnson, I want to thank you for being with us, one of five peace activists who climbed a crane on Saturday and unfurled a banner that said, Wage Peace Now. You're listening to Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report, broadcasting, well, just blocks from where, near where more than 6,000 people are either incinerated or entombed, where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. When we come back, we'll be joined by Jennifer Harbury talking about the loosening of restrictions, about putting human rights abusers on the CIA payroll. Also, we'll look at the policy of assassinations and should this be acceptable in a civilized society. Finally, Rabbi Michael Lerner and Jim Wallace will join us, peace churches and synagogues, talking about how they're mobilizing. In our second hour, for those stations that are staying with us, we'll be doing a teach-in on Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan, and we'll also go to Britain to find out about the anti-war protests there. Stay with us. Kill for Peace, the Fugs, here on Democracy Now! in Exile, War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The World Trade Center and Pentagon attacks have led to harsh congressional criticism of alleged intelligence failures by the FBI and CIA and calls for a rapid expansion of their budgets and powers. U.S. intelligence officials have responded by saying Congress should scrap legislation that prohibits the CIA from engaging in assassinations or using human rights abusers as intelligence agents. These restrictions, they say, may have hindered their ability to investigate and undermine alleged terrorist organizations. Human rights groups have responded with horror. They say it's not hard to find examples of what the CIA means when it calls for a relaxation of these laws on assassination and working with human rights abusers. Friday was the 25th anniversary of the assassination of Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt. Orlando Letelier was the former Chilean defense minister under Salvador Allende. Ronnie Moffitt worked at the Institute for Policy Studies. They were killed by Chilean security forces backed by the U.S. in Washington, D.C. On September 21, 1976, Letelier was killed by a car bomb in the nation's capital. The assassinations took place less than 2 weeks after General Augusto Pinochet's military regime revoked Letelier's Chilean citizenship in the midst of a U.S.-backed campaign against Chilean activists. We turn now, though, to Jennifer Harberry, who's personally experienced what this means. She is an activist and lawyer for Native American prisoner Leonard Peltier. Her husband, Ephraim Bamaca Velasquez, was captured, tortured, and killed by Guatemalan military officials on the payroll of the CIA. Welcome to Democracy Now! in Exile, Jennifer.
Thank you, Amy. It's good to talk to you, and thanks for all your amazing coverage of everything that's been happening.
It's great to have you with us, and if you can speak up as loud as possible, can you specifically address the issue that the administration has put forward in saying that in order to conduct adequate intelligence, human rights abusers must be put on the CIA payroll?
Yes, I think there are three basic points here. Number one, when the new regulations were put into place after my husband's torture and assassination, they did not prohibit the use of unsavory characters where it was really necessary by the CIA. All that a CIA person on the ground has to do is inform his superiors that he needs to work with that person to gather intelligence and obtain permission. And in fact, CIA spokespersons, interestingly enough, have been confirming that their attempts to gather intelligence have not been hampered by that restriction. Number two, I think we have to remember that CIA activities divide into two categories. The first category would be bona fide intelligence gathering to protect civilians, which is, of course, the original role and responsibility of the CIA. I think in the context of gathering information to make sure that a jumbo jet with passengers aboard is not hijacked or to prevent bombings or other acts of terror, that there is reason to have more flexibility, although I think that basic human rights tenets should still be in place. I think we have to remember, though, that the CIA has always carried out a second category of activities which were not within their original role, which is specifically to force our own socioeconomic requirements basically down the throats of neighboring countries. I would use, for example, the example that you just used, which is Chile. September 11th is also a very notorious anniversary within Chile. That is the anniversary that the CIA assisted Pinochet in literally bombing the Capitol building flat in Santiago, assassinating President Allende, who was legally and popularly elected, and herding thousands of Chileans into the National Stadium. I think that the shock of the Chilean citizens that day must have been very similar to what we ourselves were feeling as we watched the World Trade Center towers go down. And counted up to 5,000 victims, sadly, it seems much more. I think that the vast majority of activities by the CIA have, in fact, been to aid and abet acts of terror in other countries. I would certainly give the example of Guatemala, where we spent the last 35 years aiding and collaborating closely with the Guatemalan military, which was found guilty of genocide by the United Nations Truth Commission. They were also found responsible for 93% of the war crimes, which included the torture and disappearance of 200,000 civilians and the mass destruction of 660 Mayan villages. I think that we have to be very careful before we remove those human rights restrictions that are in place. They're to protect the sanctity of human life of all persons, not just our own. And if our government, without telling us and without our permission, foments hatred against all Americans abroad, I really fear that eventually more disasters will come home to roost within our country.
We're talking to Jennifer Harbury, whose husband was killed by Guatemalan military on the payroll of the Central Intelligence Agency. You talked about Chile. William Blum is also with us. He's author of Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II. He's someone who knows about the U.S. government, having been a State Department official himself. Welcome to Democracy Now! in Exile.
Hi, Amy. Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. I mentioned Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt, killed 25 years ago last Friday, actually not in Chile, but in Washington, D.C. Can you comment briefly on their case and how that fits into the issues at hand today?
Well, that was part of what is known as Operation Condor, which the U.S. and six or so other South American countries were exchanging information about so-called communists or anyone that they thought of as being the enemy, and they jointly engaged in assassination attacks upon these people. On the question of the U.S. government or the CIA associating with so-called unsavories, we have to keep in mind that it's not simply a matter of obtaining information from these people. These unsavories are America's allies on the same side of civil conflicts. And we insist that these people are fighting on the side of freedom and democracy. And we champion their cause because it's our cause as well. And we do all kinds of things with them, including socializing with them. And these people even betray their own government on behalf of the U.S. So it's a very close relationship. It's not simply CIA agents holding their nose while they get information. These are close comrades, so to speak, of the U.S. government.
This is an issue that we have discussed before on the War and Peace Report, but Henry Kissinger is being paraded out on the networks as a terrorism expert. Now, under the criterion it takes one to know one, maybe it would be appropriate, but that's not how they are identifying him, but as someone who fights terrorism. Can you talk, as you do in your book, about Kissinger's involvement in various terrorist acts?
Well, that's a subject which has been discussed quite a bit in the past few months, largely due to the articles in the book by Christopher Hitchens. I don't have to repeat all of that information. It's just his main crimes, Kissinger's, were in, besides Chile, in Angola and Vietnam. Angola is not too often mentioned in his context, but he prolonged that war. He was the chief cheerleader for the U.S. involvement in Angola, which in a civil war which is still going on. And he lied to the Congress about it repeatedly, and that's one of his many black marks, which is not emphasized enough.
We're talking to Bill Blum, author of Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II. Bill, do you see this, what they're talking about, a relaxing of rules to put, quote, unsavory intelligence sources on the payroll, because in order to infiltrate an unsavory organization, the people themselves would have to be unsavory to be accepted? Do you have these ever really been tightened restrictions on this?
I would doubt it very much. And the same applies to the so-called ban on assassinations. That has never been enforced. The U.S. has been attempting assassinations on a regular basis ever since President Ford first issued a so-called ban against them, as recently as 2 years ago, we attempted to assassinate Slobodan Milosevic. You know, we dropped bombs on his house, and if that isn't an attempt to assassinate somebody, I don't know what is. So this, besides which, the rule put in place by Ford was overruled and changed by Reagan more than once. So this has not been a continuous 25 years of a ban on assassinations. Reagan specifically issued orders to allow the CIA and other agents of the U.S. government to assassinate people. The media called it a license to kill. This was in 1985. And so it's gone back and forth. Officially, the ban has been in place at times, and at other times, the ban has been rescinded. There has not been a continuous policy, except that the desire to assassinate people when it was felt necessary has been continuous.
Jennifer Harbury, there are those who would say it is better to move in and try to kill one person that you have identified as responsible for a crime than bombing an entire population. What do you think of that as a justification of assassination?
I would have one major question for that person. Is there really some reason why that person could not be arrested, brought before a court of law, and given a fair trial? If that person engaged in combat with those attempting to arrest that person, then I would say that that death was a combat death or a death in the course of resisting an arrest. But if we are assassinating that person simply because we wish to assassinate him or her, and because perhaps we don't have enough evidence to bring him before a court of law, then I have very grave concerns. What is our excuse for avoiding the legal system and giving the person a fair trial? That's the third option that is never mentioned.
And finally, Jennifer Harbury, on the issue in your own case of your husband who was killed by Guatemalan military on the U.S. payroll, what do you think this will mean today?
In terms of the way we would carry out the new warfare technique?
That's right.
I'm very concerned that it will mean that the United States government continues to do what they have done in the past, which is to hire locals to actually torture, abuse, and extrajudicially execute prisoners that may be combatants and may also be civilians in order to obtain information from them or simply to impose terror locally so as to obtain their political goals. And I think that at that point in time, we're aiding and abetting kidnapping, torture, and murder, and we've become the very terrorists that we're seeking to quell.
Have people approached you, Congress members, senators, as they talk about relaxation of these restrictions?
I've been in communication with a number of legislative aides that I had worked closely with before, yes. And there are concerns, but I think right now on the Hill, there is an understandable and very human wish to take immediate action and to some extent to obtain revenge. But I think that we have to be much more level-headed here. And if we take away the human rights protections that have been so hard won during the past century, starting even with the Geneva Conventions, then I'm extremely worried about what is going to happen to our own young men and women in our own armed forces. If we take away those protections from those we are fighting against, then those protections will not exist for our own people. And I think that would be a very sad day indeed.
Ultimately, what do you understand happened to your husband?
Everardo was captured alive by the Guatemalan military in 1992. He was secretly detained, and they faked his death, saying that he died in combat in order to torture him slowly for his information. They tortured him for approximately 2 years. He was drugged repeatedly. He was beaten repeatedly. He was seen being injected with toxic substances that caused his body to swell grotesquely and apparently caused hemorrhages in one arm and one leg. He attempted many times to escape and was deemed highly intelligent and therefore placed in a full body cast to prevent his escape. He was also drugged repeatedly in an effort to make him talk, but apparently never did. When he was being tortured, it was under medical supervision to avoid accidentally killing him. Apparently, the Army eventually decided that no level of torture would ever cause him or force him to talk, and they decided to kill him. He was either thrown from a helicopter or he was dismembered and scattered across a sugarcane field in 1994.
And the people you did it, who did it, how you trace them to the United States and the Central Intelligence Agency?
Well, it took me nearly 3 years to find out what had become of him, including a number of hunger strikes, two in Guatemala and one, of course, in Washington, D.C. He was detained secretly by a very high-level group of Army intelligence officials, or G2 officers, in the Guatemalan military, many of whom, I believe up to 12 of whom, were trained at the School of Americas, and many of whom were, in fact, paid CIA informants. The CIA was aware that he had been captured alive and was being tortured in secret for his information, and so informed the White House and the State Department 6 days after his capture. Again, it took me 3 years to find out what had become of him. They were also informed while I was looking for him in Guatemala that he was still alive. In other words, if they had told me the truth when they received the truth, I could have saved his life. So we have the United States government literally paying their Guatemalan Army counterparts to torture my husband to obtain more information. That is aiding and abetting. We also have United States officials standing in front of the door to his torture cell saying, "Don't look in here, there is nobody there." That's also aiding and abetting. It's also denying me my own rights to save my husband's life. This is exactly the kind of terrorist activity that I fear, if more broadly inflicted than already has been, and it has been broadly inflicted enough throughout Latin America, that is for certain. But if it continues to be so broadly inflicted on our neighbors and other countries, that level of hatred that is understandably fomented abroad, whether we as citizens know of these activities, condone them, or authorize them in any way, that hatred fomented abroad is going to have very negative consequences for all of our own citizens at home. And well, I think that's a security issue that has not been properly considered by our own officials.
Well, Jennifer Harbury, I want to thank you very much for joining us from Texas, and William Blum, author of Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II, for joining us from Washington, D.C. And again, the top news story today that we read, just to remember, we're not only talking about putting individual human rights abusers on the CIA payroll, but President Bush has asked Congress for authority to waive all existing restrictions on U.S. military assistance and weapons exports for the next 5 years to any country he desires. These restrictions were put in place because of countries with massive human rights abusing records, like Indonesia. You are listening to Democracy Now! and Exiles, War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute. Thank you. Wake up, Neville Brothers here on Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Coming up, we're going to talk about religious leaders and peace in these days leading up to war. But first, a little promo of our second hour. Jeffrey C. is writing a book on the Central Asia region. President Clinton spoke with the Russian president this weekend. In addition to that, Kazakhstan became the first ex-Soviet state to promise practical support to the U.S. war on, quote, terrorism. The significance of the Central Asia region, Jeffrey C., that we're going to be talking about in the next hour.
Well, Central Asia has long been the nexus for shifting superpower alliances, and we see that continuing today. We see that Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and some of the other countries in the region are aligning with the United States and Russia against some of the more radical elements of Islam, and we'll be talking about how that process is proceeding.
We'll also be going to Moscow to look at the Russian response. In the days since the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, people of all faiths and even little faith have flocked to churches, mosques, synagogues, seeking comfort, prayer, and a sense of meaning in the midst of the suffering. Mainstream religious leaders around the country have organized interfaith prayer services proclaiming unity and preaching tolerance, such as the one held yesterday at Yankee Stadium that was attended by more than 20,000 people. It was presided over by the commander of the Pacific Fleet, who prayed for God to be on the side of the United States as it prepares to go to war. But there's been another religious response as well, one that mirrors the peace movement now springing up in communities around the country. Many prominent Jewish, Muslim, and Christian leaders are moving beyond mourning and prayer to mobilization and protest, seeking a religious response to terrorism consistent with progressive values and the likelihood of war. We're joined on the phone by Rabbi Michael Lerner, who is editor of Tikkun magazine. He joins us from the Bay Area. And Jim Wallace, Reverend, who is the editor of Sojourners magazine. He joins us from Washington. Well, let's talk about the message you are putting out right now, Reverend Jim Wallace.
Good morning. Good morning, Michael.
Hi, Jim.
Well, I think it is appropriate for religious communities to begin with a pastoral response to those who are in mourning. The grief in this country is something that we have not known internally for a long, long time, and that's appropriate. And to pray is very appropriate, and to go deeply into our, dig deeper into our spiritual roots. But the religious community must offer more than prayer and support for those who are suffering. It must offer religious guidance and wisdom for our response. And number one, that means, in my view, we've got to focus on the language of justice, invoking the rule of law, and try and move away from the language of war, which has no moral boundaries. Two, we have to defend our Arab American and Muslim fellow citizens here against the vulnerability they're feeling. And three, I think we have to see this as a teachable moment to understand the roots and causes of what's just happened to us. That's the prophetic word. But I think we have to do it in a very careful way, so that we don't sound like, if you will, a left-wing equivalent of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, as if, you know, in this case, American foreign policy, which I've opposed for years, and American militarism, which I am strongly opposed to, and, of course, U.S. economic global dominance make it that we deserved, ordinary Americans deserve to be attacked. That's what Falwell and Robertson were saying about their grievances, of course, you know, gays and feminists and abortion. We must not sound like a left-wing equivalent of them as we talk about draining the swamp of injustice out of which the mosquitoes of terrorism breed. We have to do that, but we have to do that in a way that doesn't lose our connection with the American people.
Reverend Wallace, can you elaborate on that, what Falwell and Robertson have said? Because I don't think a lot of people quite understand who they are blaming.
Well, they're saying that somehow the attack on America is God's judgment for abortion, homosexuality. I think they said the ACLU. I think they even blamed the people for the American way. And it was the most irresponsible, inappropriate. It was an all-time low for the Reverends Falwell and Robertson. One good thing, maybe, that comes out of this is nobody will listen to them anymore. But it was a terrible kind of thing to say. I'm saying that we must be careful not to sound like them when we talk about the sins, if you will, of American foreign policy, of which there are many, and U.S. global domination and militarism and so on. I'm opposed to U.S. policy in the Middle East. I was on the West Bank and Gaza. Michael's been a prophet on this, calling for a just solution there. We must do that, but we must be careful how we do it, that we don't lose our connection to the American people. Michael, you got a better sense of that than most people.
Rabbi Michael Lerner.
Well, of course, I feel that this is, I agree with everything Jim has said, and think that we certainly need to approach these issues with a sense of concern for the pain of the American people and the legitimate anger and upset that people experience at this moment. At the same time, this is also a particularly good week from the Jewish standpoint for atonement. This is the week of the Day of Atonement, and it seems to me that the entire world needs a period of atonement to understand what it is that is at the root of this level of violence, and to recognize that we're all implicated in it. In my view, we live in one world system, and that one world system is screwed up. It's screwed up because we have all learned to look at every other human being primarily in terms of how they can be of use to us, how we can advance our own interests, how we can, how they can be helpful, how they can be made an instrument of our will. We've unlearned. We've not been able to recognize other human beings as created in the image of God, and that. That is a root problem, which then reflects in the whole economic worldview that we have, which allows us to close our eyes to the ways in which we are implicated directly in the incredible poverty and the incredible material deprivation that and the pain that follows from it for literally billions of people on the planet. So we close our eyes to all this, and then we're amazed that people are angry, or people are depressed, or people are crazy. People act in hurtful ways, and yet the hurtful ways that they act in are only exaggerations of the hurtful ways that are endemic in the whole lifestyle that is a product of the social, economic, political system that is ours and that is a worldwide system. So it's not a question of identifying America as the problem. There is a problem. There is a root problem. It's a worldwide problem. And the desanctification of human life that is endemic in our world system, that allows us to exploit peoples around the world, that allows us to live on 25% of the world's wealth with 5% of the world's population here, and simply be completely piggy about taking up the wealth of the world without regard to what's going to happen to the rest of the world, that can allows us to turn our backs on the fate of others as we avoid or reject every ecological treaty, that allows us to turn our backs on the fate of others as we fund military regimes around the world. All of that a reflection of the ability to desanctify other human beings, to not take the value of other human beings seriously. Well, that ethos has become a worldwide ethos and allows finally for some person in outrage at that system to inappropriately treat us the exact same way, to desanctify our human life, to think that our human life is irrelevant, that to think that it's perfectly appropriate to murder in the name of their ideals.
Rabbi Lerner, these are the days of awe in the Jewish faith between the High Holy Days, Rosh Hashanah, and coming up Yom Kippur, the one-day fast of the year, the Day of Atonement. How are you organizing? And we only have 4 minutes here, and I want to ask how Reverend Jim Wallace is mobilizing communities of faith right now.
Well, we at Tikkun Magazine have started a new organization that actually this week, as a result in part of what's going on in the world, called the Tikkun Community. And we're trying to bring people from all faiths into the Tikkun Community. And one of the first steps is to ask people to engage in this deep process of atonement, in which we ask people to go inward, to look at the ways in which we as individuals have embodied the ethos of selfishness and materialism in our society. But simultaneously, we're asking, this is not only an inward process, it's an outward process as well, in which we want to challenge the, that ethos in American society. So we've put forward the idea of a social responsibility amendment to the federal constitution that would require corporations to reincorporate once every 20 years and only get a new corporate charter if they could prove a history of social responsibility in the way that they acted both domestically and internationally. This is a period for a fundamental transformation, and America would not face this kind of hatred and this kind of attack if America were being, or at least, let's put it this way, the terrorists would have a lot more trouble recruiting in a world in which America was seen as the number one force calling for social justice, for redistribution of wealth, if America was the force that was seen as the most generous and open-hearted society rather than the center of the ethos of selfishness and materialism. So we're calling upon individuals and also collectively for a worldwide atonement and an understanding of the way which we individually and our society collectively is implicated in the screwed up world that produces this kind of craziness.
And Reverend Jim Wallace, how are you organizing?
Very practically, we have a website, www.sojo.net, S-O-J-O.net. We have every day an email newsletter, Sojo Mail, that comes out of there with perspective on what's happening, practical things churches, synagogues, mosques are doing. We have a statement now signed by 2,000 religious leaders, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, across the board, Buddhist now, and that statement's called Deny Them Their Victory, a Religious Response to Terrorism. That statement is becoming an action network. You can get it off the website and sign it, and you can be a part of what faith communities are doing around the country, which is, number one, raise a voice that we not respond in a way that attacks and harms more innocent lives. Number two, that we protect Arab American Muslim citizens in this country who are under threat. Number three, that we use this as a teachable moment, that we look at ourselves and look at this nation and try and move toward a world in which the violence that is systemic every day, that affects so many, and the terrorism that arises from that desperation, desperate people do desperate things.
Well, Reverend
that
Jim,
we deal with that.
Reverend Jim Wallace and Rabbi Michael Lerner, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Reverend Wallace of Sojourners Magazine, Rabbi Lerner from Tikkun Magazine, and that does it for the program for this hour. We'll be going on with a second hour. You can mail us your comments at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan, our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland is at the helm at www.wbix.org, where you can hear us. Special thanks to Chase Pearson, Tony Riddle, Rick Youngers, Hoy No, Karen Renucci, Dee Dee Halleck, Lenny Charles, Lizzie Ratner, and Sam Delgado, and our hosts at Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Suno. Thank you to Pacifica stations and affiliates, KPFA and KFCF, and all our affiliates. We are Pacifica. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.